From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, now that spring is here, we talk about how to buy, store, and prepare fresh vegetables with Jack Bishop, author of the new cookbook, Vegetables Every Day. He writes about food for the New York Times, Cooks Illustrated, and Natural Health magazine. Also, how to fry the perfect egg and prepare omelets and frittatas. We talk with food writer Marie Simmons, author of the cookbook, The Good Egg. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the R&B group, Public Announcement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has approved a nearly $2 trillion budget for the 2002 fiscal year. The vote to pass the Republican-backed measure was 222 to 205, mostly along party lines. President Bush welcomed passage of the bill, which closely follows his plan for reduced spending and cuts in income tax rates. He says the tax cut is needed to stimulate the economy. House Democrats said today that the economy would be helped more by a $60 billion tax reduction that would take effect this year. Following a plan endorsed by Democratic leaders in the Senate, they said that immediate tax rebates would get cash into the hands of consumers more quickly and would be more fair than the president's plan. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned a $107 million verdict against anti-abortion activists. The Federal Appeals Court said the verdict infringed on a website's free speech rights. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
The website called the Nuremberg Files listed the names and addresses of doctors who performed abortions. It called them baby killers, and when a doctor was killed, it crossed his name off the site. But it never advocated violence. Planned Parenthood and a group of doctors sued the website operators and other anti-abortion activists. And 2 years ago, a jury in Portland, Oregon, ruled that the website encouraged people to harm the doctors. Now the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned the verdict, drawing language from Supreme Court rulings. It said the threat against the doctors must be explicit and likely to cause imminent lawless action. The appeals court said this kind of speech, in a public forum and filled with hyperbole, was not an explicit threat, and therefore it's protected by the First Amendment. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli helicopters attacked Palestinian targets in the Gaza Strip today in retaliation for a wave of bombings, the most recent of which killed two Israeli teenagers. The BBC's Hillary Anderson has more from Jerusalem.
The Israeli army has hit headquarters of Yasser Arafat's presidential bodyguard unit, known as Force 17, as well as other targets that the Israelis believe are associated with the recent spate of attacks on Israel. Ambulances are on the scene, and a number of people have been admitted to hospital in Gaza. So far, the injured appear to be Palestinian security men. The Israeli government says it holds the Palestinian Authority and its leader Yasser Arafat directly responsible for the wave of attacks on Israelis. Over the last few days, there have been three bomb blasts which have killed three people and injured over 30 Israelis. The Islamic extremist group Hamas and Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility for two of the blasts. Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority say they had nothing to do with the violence.
The BBC's Hillary Anderson. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 162 points, or 1.6%. It closed at 9,785 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 118 points. This is NPR. Calm Air is now canceling all flights for the next week as the pilot strike enters its third day. There's no sign of an end to the walkout against the country's second-largest regional carrier. Jay Hanselman reports from member station WNKU.
Calm Air, which is part of Delta Airlines, says it will cancel all flights 7 days in advance until an agreement is reached with its pilots union. Calm Air sales and marketing representative Michael Keithley says the company's decision was based on customer convenience.
The company wants to make every effort to get these customers on alternate flights and give them enough advance notice of flight changes so they can adjust their travel plans accordingly.
Keithley says the airline is entering a busy season with many spring break travelers. No new talks are planned between Calm Air and its pilots union. The pilots walked off the job early Monday morning. They're seeking a company-funded retirement plan, more rest between flights, better wages, and pay for all the hours they're on duty, not just time flying. For NPR News, I'm Jay Hanselman in Highland Heights, Kentucky.
Two dog owners appeared in a California court today on murder and manslaughter charges stemming from a dog attack on one of their neighbors 2 months ago. Prosecutors say Marjorie Noller and Robert Knoll were arrested last night in Corning, California, a small town about 170 miles from San Francisco. A county judge said he set bail at $2 million for Noller and $1 million for her husband, in part because the two were so far from San Francisco at the time of their arrest. Noller and Knoll, both lawyers, were caring for two large Canary Island Mastiffs that allegedly killed their neighbor, 33-year-old Diane Whipple, in the hallway of their apartment house. In stocks today, the Nasdaq lost 118 points, or 6%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mad cow disease and foot and mouth disease might have you thinking more about vegetables. My guest Jack Bishop has plenty of suggestions for making vegetable dishes that are delicious, and he has advice on buying and storing vegetables. Bishop is the author of the new cookbook, Vegetables Every Day. He writes about food for the New York Times, Cooks Illustrated, and Natural Health magazine. His other books include The Complete Italian Vegetarian Cookbook and Lasagna. Although he's not a vegetarian, he says that vegetables are the heart of all meals in his home. I asked him what he loves about them.
I think my favorite thing about vegetables is the connection that you have with the seasons. I mean, if you eat pasta, if you eat chicken, it's pretty much the same 365 days of the year. Pasta is pasta, chicken is chicken. But when you walk into the produce market, the vegetable aisle at the supermarket, you never know exactly what you're going to find. And there's that element of surprise that you stumble upon something that looks absolutely wonderful that you just have to take home and do something with. There's also the connection to the season. And I think we've certainly lost that to a certain extent with mass production of vegetables all around the world and being able to enjoy many vegetables 12 months of the year. But I think especially if you shop at farm stands or places that are really focusing on local produce, it allows you to sort of stay in tune with those natural rhythms.
Let's talk about some of the best basic ways of preparing vegetables. And why don't we start with grilling? Because I think that's becoming an increasingly popular way of doing vegetables. And it's got a really interesting taste and texture if you grill them.
Well, one of the things I like about grilling is what you're doing is it's a dry heat that is causing moisture in the vegetables to be lost. So what you're really doing is concentrating the flavor. I mean, if you think about asparagus and if you were to boil it, you're sort of losing a lot of the flavor of the vegetable to the water, and then you pour the water down the sink. But if you were to lightly oil the asparagus, maybe sprinkle it with some coarse salt and throw it on the grill, you are concentrating the flavor of the vegetables. The sort of natural sweetness and sugars in the vegetables come to the forefront. You get that sort of lightly crisped exterior, which adds tons of flavor as well as texture. And almost any vegetable can be put on the grill. And I think as more and more people do their cooking of other things, whether it's the meat, the fish, the chicken on the grill, it just makes total sense to then do the vegetables on the grill as well.
Say you're grilling zucchini. How would you oil them so that they don't stick to the grill? But on the other hand, so that they don't get too oily.
I usually just put the vegetables in a bowl, drizzle no more than a tablespoon of oil, and then use my hands. They're the best tool to make sure that you've completely coated all the surfaces. They just have to be very, very lightly coated. As you said, you just want to prevent them from sticking. There's no reason to add more oil than is absolutely necessary. If you don't want to get your hands dirty, you can certainly put them on a baking tray and use a pastry brush and brush the oil lightly over the surface. But I find it more effective and quicker to just get in there and use my hands.
What kind of oil do you recommend for grilling or for stir frying?
Well, when I'm grilling, I really like to use olive oil. I think in all of my cooking, I feel like if you're going to add oil to food, it maybe should bring something besides just fat, and I want some flavor. So I use extra virgin olive oil. I think it has a wonderful flavor that complements almost all the vegetables. And when I stir fry, I use a roasted peanut oil. Not a highly refined peanut oil, but one that may say roasted or toasted peanut oil. And when you open the bottle of the oil, it actually smells like freshly roasted peanuts, and it just adds a wonderful flavor to a stir fry.
What are the advantages of stir frying vegetables?
Well, with stir-fry vegetables, you get sort of concentrated flavors that we were talking about that you get from the grill, but you also get a sauce there. And I think that that's, you know, part of the appeal. You can add anything. You can add orange juice and fermented black beans. You could add lemon and ginger. And so you're cooking and saucing the vegetable at the same time, and it's a sort of neat way of combining two processes in one.
What do you think of steaming vegetables?
Steaming vegetables is a nice alternative to boiling, which is a method that my mother used a lot, and I wish she had done more steaming when I was a kid because it really preserves the texture and flavor better of the vegetables. But once the vegetable is steamed, you really do need to do something to it. Steamed broccoli, steamed green beans are a bit bland on their own and really need a really highly flavorful vinaigrette or some other sort of sauce to perk them up, to make them extremely palatable.
Jack Bishop is my guest. His new book is called Vegetables Every Day. It's a guide to buying and cooking vegetables. Well, let's talk a little bit about perhaps the most loved of vegetables in America, the potato. Mr. Popularity. You have a good alternative to French fries in your book. It's oven fries.
I love oven fries. I mean, it's one of those things I do not feel guilty feeding my children oven fries. If they want them 5 nights a week, I'm happy to provide them 5 nights a week. In addition to the much reduced mess, I mean, there's nothing like deep-fried French fried potatoes, but you really don't want to be doing it every day. And to oven fry, there's just a couple of tricks that you want to use. You want to make sure that you've got the oven really nice and hot. 425 is a reasonable temperature to start out at. And you want to make sure that you've cut the potatoes into fairly long wedges. I usually cut the potato lengthwise into 8 or 10 pieces. And you've got to oil them lightly and let the baking sheet preheat in the oven, so that when the oven comes up to temperature, you pull up out the baking sheet, you throw the potatoes on, and they immediately start to sizzle. Let them turn just once during the process. You want them to get a nice golden brown crust. And after about 40, 50 minutes, they're going to be absolutely perfect.
So you just leave them in the oven, turn them once, and it's...
Just turn them once. I mean, I think a lot of times people try to turn them too often, and they end up not getting that nice golden brown crust on them. So I let them go at least 25 minutes. Turn them, a pair of tongs works nicely. Turn each piece, get it on another side that's not brown, and then another 15 to 25 minutes, depending on the size of the potatoes, and you've got perfectly cooked, nice, crisp oven fries. And you can probably cook 2 pounds of potatoes with maybe 2 tablespoons of oil, which is really not that much when you're talking about serving 4 or 6 people.
Do you have a good suggestion for improving on your basic microwaved baked potato? It gets the job done, the microwave, but not in a very interesting way.
I gotta say, it's one of the unkindest things you can do to your poor potato is to put it in the microwave. And certainly if you are pressed for time to turn on the oven to 450, cook the potato in the microwave halfway and then transfer it to the oven. I mean, my feeling is that a potato that's cooked strictly in the microwave is just going to be very soggy and flabby, and that you could cut the cooking time drastically if you start it in the microwave and then finish it in the hot oven so that the exterior can crisp up and more steam can escape. But really, the oven the entire time is the best way to cook the potato.
How long would you be doing it in your technique if you were just doing the second half in the oven?
I would say about 15 minutes.
That doesn't sound too bad.
No, it's not too bad. And honestly, you think, oh, it's going to take 45 minutes or an hour to bake a potato completely in the oven. But if you just put that in and do that first, as soon as you walk in the door, odds are it's going to take you that long to sort of unwind, get ready to really start cooking. And you can probably time it so that the potatoes come out of the oven just as dinner's ready.
Let's get to one of the more controversial vegetables, and I'm thinking of broccoli. Some people just really think of themselves as hating broccoli. Why do you think some people find broccoli so offensive?
Well, the broccoli has a very unusual chemical compound that once the broccoli is cooked more than about 7 or 8 minutes in boiling water, this sulfur smell just becomes overpowering. And the broccoli really is pretty... I would say, I don't want to say disgusting, but it almost can become so that inedible if you overcook it. Besides losing the texture and becoming mushy and becoming that horrible drab gray color. So I think a lot of people, you know, they think of broccoli they had in the cafeteria line at school that was probably cooked for 20 minutes and just say, oh, I can't possibly fathom actually buying broccoli myself and making it. But as long as you make sure not to cook the broccoli much more than about 5 minutes, I think it's got a wonderful flavor. I think broccoli can even be sweet. And I think that, you know, strong flavored vinaigrettes and sauces, I mean, I love to do a little spicy balsamic dressing with black olives. So I just steam the broccoli, comes out of the pan. I toss it in a bowl with vinaigrette with the balsamic vinegar, hot red pepper flakes, a little garlic, some red wine vinegar, some olive oil, and some pitted and sliced kalamatas. And it's a really great counterpoint to the broccoli flavor.
Give us another suggestion, too, for like a really simple way of preparing tasty broccoli.
Well, the other way is a stir fry. I think that broccoli with a sort of sesame stir fry, which is a Chinese restaurant classic, is remarkably easy. And I just saute the broccoli till it's sort of bright green. And then I'll add a sauce with a little soy sauce, a little sesame seeds, maybe some garlic, some ginger. Throw the cover on the pan to trap some of the heat and the moisture and to really cook the broccoli through and let that sauce reduce down a little bit. And you've got a great quick stir fry.
Now, one of the problems about broccoli is that it's kind of hard to digest. It can cause a lot of intestinal gas. Do you have any suggestions for making it easier on the stomach?
The suggestion is frequency of eating. I mean, with broccoli, with legumes, which give some people problems. I mean, I see all these things out there that you can add to your food, and they might work, they might not, I'm not sure. But I found that the more you eat these things, the more your system becomes accustomed to them. So that if you have broccoli once a month, odds are, and if broccoli gives you problems, it's probably going to continue to give you problems. And there's not a lot you can do in the cooking process that's going to reduce that. But if you eat broccoli on a regular basis, along with legumes and all these other things, your system will learn to tolerate them. Even if you think that that won't happen, it really will.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Bishop. He's a food writer who writes for several magazines and the New York Times. His new book is called Vegetables Every Day. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk more about buying and cooking vegetables. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jack Bishop. He writes about food for several magazines and for the New York Times. His new book is called Vegetables Every Day. Let's talk about carrots. You know, you said that carrots have more natural sugar than any vegetable except beets. And I figured, oh, no wonder I use carrots so much when I'm preparing dinner. It must be the sugar.
It is the sugar. I mean, that's the reason why kids like carrots. They have that sweetness. But I think, you know, the carrots are pretty rock hard, and people think, oh, well, I might nibble on some carrot sticks. But they think, in terms of cooking carrots, there are very few things that people do. You know, they sort of do that sugared, glazed carrots, if they do anything with carrots. And I think that the flavor and that sweetness lends itself to so many treatments. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is to just peel the carrots, cut them into small dice, maybe half-inch pieces, and then boil them till they're tender but not mushy, maybe 8 or 9 minutes. Drain the carrots and then toss them with a light vinaigrette. I mean, I might do something with North African spices that's got a little olive oil, lemon juice, some sweet paprika, some cumin, some cinnamon, and then a final flourish of some parsley or cilantro. And you can take the same idea and do Indian spices, Asian spices, and it's a really lovely side dish with a roast chicken, most anything. And it's one of those things that people say, oh, carrots. I never knew you could do that with carrots. As I said, you know, that sort of maple glazed or honey glazed carrots seems to be the only thing people know, and they think, oh, it's a holiday dish. But I think carrots you can do so much more with.
Yeah, the problem I find with like the honeyed carrots is if carrots are already sweet, why make them sweeter? Why not use the sweetness as a counterpoint to something else?
Well, right. And that's why I think the spices work really nicely. I mean, this to do curry or to do some Szechuan peppercorns, to sort of take it in a different direction. I mean, I think that maple glazed carrot is, you know, it's a holiday thing where all you do is do sweetness, and you're thinking that turkey, and you keep adding sweet elements to the meal. But that's really something you only want to do once a year. And in sort of day-to-day cooking, it's better to play off the sweetness and come up with a foil for it.
Let's move on to tomatoes. I think tomatoes are a great cause of frustration now. It is so difficult to find a tomato with any taste to it. And I think that's become true even in the summer, unless you have access to a really good farmer's market. I've just been finding that even from the farmer's markets, tomatoes don't taste the way they used to.
It's really true. I mean, the tomato has really been subjected to all kinds of indignities, including, you know, trying to produce a decent tomato for supermarkets in January, which is a fool's errand that no one will ever succeed at. But I have a couple of strategies besides the just, you know, buying a local tomato, which is always going to be your best bet. Cherry tomatoes, I think, are actually not so bad, and I like to sauté them. The little bit of heat, maybe 2 or 3 minutes in a hot skillet, releases some of their juices and really makes them much more appealing. And at other times of the year where you feel like the large tomatoes just are not going to have any flavor, but you really have a hankering for some tomatoes, try some of the cherry tomatoes and simply just cut them in half, or if they're very small, leave them whole and sauté them in a little olive oil. You can finish with garlic and basil, with a little olives and feta cheese. And it's a really sort of nice alternative, especially if you want to cook the tomatoes.
You use canned tomatoes when you're cooking, too.
Whenever I'm doing a dish where the tomatoes are an ingredient as opposed to making a tomato salad or a tomato side dish, I use canned tomatoes. And I just love the canned tomatoes from California. They're picked ripe, which you can, it's not the case with most of the fresh tomatoes you see in the supermarket, which are picked green and then shipped that way. And they just have that sweet summer flavor. I buy the organic tomatoes, and I think they're just wonderful. And I use them in all of my pasta sauces and any of my cooking where I want the tomatoes to be an ingredient. And they're incredibly convenient. I buy the diced canned tomatoes, which are simply whole tomatoes packed in some juice. And they've got just fabulous flavor and no preparation time.
So how do you use them? Give us a good recipe.
I make my standard tomato sauce. It starts with the canned tomatoes. And I will just warm some olive oil and some garlic in a saucepan. Add the tomatoes. Let it simmer just about 10 minutes. The longer you cook the tomatoes, I find that the less flavor they have. You're really trying to preserve that sort of fresh, sweet flavor. So you just cook it long enough to thicken the sauce. You can finish with some basil. You can finish with another herb. And it's the simplest tomato sauce. And it makes me wonder why anyone would open a jar of tomato sauce, which has, you know, been cooked forever and honestly has almost no tomato flavor, when you can make your own tomato sauce in 10 minutes.
Jack Bishop is my guest. He's a food writer who has a new book called Vegetables Every Day. Portobello mushrooms have really caught on. And, I mean, in restaurants, you can even find portobello mushroom sandwiches on many menus. What do you do with portobellos?
I love to do an open-faced sandwich with the portobellos. It's really, I guess, what you would call a bruschetta as opposed to a sandwich. But I grill a big, nice, thick piece of country bread. You can do it in the toaster, under the broiler, it doesn't matter. I then, for the first layer, I take some white beans and mash them up and saute them in a little oil and garlic with some oregano. Put that layer on. Then I put some wilted spinach, just throw it in the pan, let it just soften up a little bit. And then I put a grilled portobello mushroom on top. And the juices from the mushrooms soak down through the spinach into the beans. And it's, you know, one of these things you have to eat with a knife and fork. There's no way you're going to be able to use your hands because it's way too messy. But it's just absolutely delicious with the contrasting textures and flavors.
That sounds really good.
It is really good.
What do you look for when you're buying portobello mushrooms?
Well, you just want to make sure that they smell right, which I know sounds like an odd thing when you're buying a mushroom, but you really want to smell the mushroom. It should smell clean, mildly earthy, no sour or acrid odors at all, and certainly not, in terms of appearance, any softness. If you see the underside where those black gills are and you see any sliminess, it's definitely means you should, you know, move on and look for another mushroom.
When you're cooking regular mushrooms, you know, when you're doing whatever it is you're going to do with them, do you peel them first?
I never peel them. I can't be bothered. And I don't take the damp paper towel either. I sometimes, if they're really dirty, just wash them, which I know is a bit of a heresy. People say, oh, you can't ever wash a mushroom. You need to use a brush and clean each one. But I find that as long as you wash them and then immediately cook them, it's fine.
You've survived.
I have survived. The mushrooms have not become horribly soggy. It's true that if you wash mushrooms and let them sit around for a while, they'll sort of almost disintegrate before your eyes and become a sort of soft mass. But as long as you wash them and cook them immediately, it's fine.
Do you have any really easy-to-make vegetable sauces that are truly quick and easy?
Well, in terms of sauces, I think most vegetables will do better with an oil-based vinaigrette than those heavy egg-based, cream-based sauces of yesteryear, you know, the hollandaise that was also popular when I was a kid. And I think just really simple vinaigrettes, a little olive oil, an acid ingredient, whether that's lemon juice, orange juice, a vinegar, a fresh herb, not a dried herb, a fresh herb, and you've got enough to sort of give a flavor boost. And you can sort of take it from there, and you can add a little bit of shallot, you can add a little bit of garlic, you can go get more complex and start adding spices to it. But at its base, that's where I would start.
Do you ever use salad dressings, like prepared salad dressings? Well, you probably don't.
I know. You know what? I lived in Italy, and I often don't even make salad dressing. What I do with my salad probably 3 nights out of 4 is I get the bottle of vinegar out and just lightly drizzle it over the salad bowl. I lightly drizzle the extra virgin olive oil over the salad. I take a teeny, teeny pinch of coarse salt, kosher salt, a couple grindings of black pepper, 2 forks, and I toss it. And I've dressed my salad. I haven't made salad dressing, but the salad is absolutely wonderful. And when you do that method, as opposed to combining the vinegar and oil in a separate bowl and then drizzling that mixture over the salad, you actually taste the vinegar and you taste the oil more clearly. So if you've got a really nice balsamic vinegar or really nice sherry vinegar, it's a great way to dress your salad.
Jack Bishop is the author of the new cookbook, Vegetables Every Day. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on preparing vegetables with Jack Bishop. Marie Simmons, author of The Good Egg, has some advice on fried eggs, omelets, and frittatas. And Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the R&B group Public Announcement. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jack Bishop, author of the new book, Vegetables Every Day, a guide to buying, storing, and preparing vegetables. Bishop also writes about food for the New York Times, Cooks Illustrated, and Natural Health magazine. What do you like to do with collard greens?
I'm not a Southerner. I'm a Northerner. So I come from the school of I'd rather not cook collards for an hour, which seems to be all the sort of classic Southern recipes. But on the other hand, I don't want the collards to be crunchy. I mean, collards are pretty tough, and you want to cook them long enough so that they're no longer tough. One of my sort of adaptation of a Southern-style recipe is to wash the greens real well and leave them a little bit damp, throw them in a big casserole or Dutch oven with some salt, and let them cook down maybe 15 or 20 minutes so that they're soft and tender, but they haven't completely dissolved. And then in another skillet, I'm just sautéing a little bit of onion. If you want to add some bacon, you can add some bacon. Stir that into the greens. Finish it with some vinegar. I like to use red wine vinegar. I think the greens really need to be offset with some acidity. And a little black pepper. And it's a really nice way to serve the collards.
Bitter greens like radicchio and endive have become very popular in a lot of restaurants now. You suggest that we think of those greens not only as salad ingredients, but as vegetables to cook. Would you recommend a recipe?
With endive, I love to braise it, which means that I will cut it in half lengthwise through that little core end. And then I will heat a little butter or oil in a sauté pan that's large enough to hold all the endive in a single layer. Then I'll add the endive to the hot pan with the cut side down and let it cook just till it's nicely browned. I'll flip it over, brown the other side, and then I'll add a liquid to the pan. You can use stock. You could use juice. One of my favorite things to do is to use apple cider. Maybe half a cup, two-thirds of a cup of apple cider. Throw in a little fresh thyme. Cover the pan. Reduce the heat. Let it cook about 15 minutes just until the endive is tender. It's absolutely delicious. And the reason why I like the cider there is, again, that sweet and bitter works really well together. And it's a great side dish.
How about radicchio?
Radicchio, what I do is I cut through the core end again. You want the pieces, the wedges, to stay intact. And I cut, depending on the size, into 6 or 8 wedges through the core end. Lightly oil them, and they're wonderful on the grill. The outside kind of chars a little bit. And you get a little bit of that grill flavor, which works real nicely with the bitterness of the radicchio, and just a little salt and pepper, and that's all I do to the radicchio, and it's wonderful.
Do you usually use radicchio and endive in your salads?
I use them in salads all the time, but as I say, I think it's really nice to think of them as vegetables because they really are vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And in salads, they're really, you can only use small amounts. I think that their flavors are pretty potent, and I always want to balance them with a tender, soft lettuce that's milder in flavor so that it's just not so overpowering. But when you cook them, whether you're cooking the endive with some cider or you're grilling the radicchio, you take a little bit of that sharpness off and you really can eat the vegetable. You can have a whole head of radicchio or a whole spear of endive and not feel like you've had this incredible bitter flavor.
In a lot of neighborhoods, we're lucky we get vegetables that are from other regions or even from other countries. What are some of the things you've been finding in markets near you that you didn't see in earlier decades that you've enjoyed using?
Well, I think that's one of the most exciting things about vegetable preparation is all of these once exotic things which have become almost commonplace in supermarkets. All these Latin root vegetables, the yuca, the malanga, the taro, Asian things, ingredients, bok choy, which is almost a staple in my house. Bok choy is a leafy cabbage, green cabbage, that's used in Chinese cooking. And it just has a wonderful flavor. I think it's a little sweeter than most of the cabbages we're used to. And I just love it.
You have some nice things to say about plantains, which are kind of like bananas, but they're not. Where do they come from? What do they taste like?
Plantains look like a banana, except if you peer real closely, you'll notice that instead of sort of being perfectly cylindrical, they've got ridges on them, usually 3 ridges. And they vary in color from green all the way to black. And in fact, the black plantains, in terms of the skin color, are the sweetest and the best, although none of them are really sweet in the way you would consider a regular banana. They're starchy, almost like a potato, but they can have floral, fruity flavor that's subtle but present. And the flesh, instead of that whitish, creamish color of a banana, often has a tinge of orange, and it's just absolutely beautiful. And I think plantains are wonderful on the grill. They're wonderful in the oven. I sometimes, instead of a baked potato, will take a plantain, one that's either yellowish black or black on the outside. I will prick it just like I prick a potato to let some steam escape, and put it in a hot oven, 425, for maybe 20 minutes until it's tender. And then I will slit the plantain in half, and then instead of the mashed potato sort of sour cream and butter route, I'll do something a little bit more tropical. And I'll do lime wedges, maybe a little Tabasco salt sauce, a little salt. And it's a really lovely change of pace from a baked potato.
What should you look for when you're buying a plantain?
Well, it depends how you want to cook the plantain. If you want to fry the plantain or make plantain chips, you want a plantain that's green and rock hard. If you're going to bake the plantain, if you're going to saute the plantain, if you're going to grill it, you want that outside skin to be yellowish black or completely black, which will indicate that the plantain is not overly starchy and has a little bit of sweetness.
How do you store vegetables in your refrigerator so that they don't get soggy?
The problem I think that a lot of people have is they take those bags from the supermarket and then they knot them or they seal them.
The plastic bags.
Those plastic bags. And basically you're creating a little greenhouse with, you know, they're spraying all the vegetables with those automatic sprayers, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But if you then put that sort of damp vegetable in a sealed bag, you've created a greenhouse and it's going to soften much, much more quickly. The plastic bags are fine. Just don't seal them. And you can even sort of poke a couple holes in them if you want to. If you notice when you get home, if you've bought spinach or another leafy green and it's really wet, you might want to take it out of that damp plastic bag. And sometimes even water will collect in the bottom of the bag. And just put it in a dry bag. You can even towel off a little extra moisture, because that moisture is really what's going to cause the vegetable to go downhill.
You have children. You know, the old joke is, I can't get my kids to eat their vegetables. Do your kids like vegetables?
The vegetables they like, they really like. And the rest of the vegetables, it's like I'm trying to feed them poison. So we stick with the broccoli, the green beans, the asparagus. Both of my kids seem to like vegetables that they can sort of pick up. And the asparagus particularly is an absolute favorite. They just think, I think, as much because of the shape as the flavor, that asparagus is the most fun thing to eat. And, you know, occasionally they'll see a vegetable that my wife and I are eating, and one of them will say, you know, they want a taste. They get a taste. Sometimes they like it, and they've discovered a new vegetable. But, you know, you really can't push it. The important thing is you want your kids to try to develop a couple of vegetables they'll reliably eat. And if they want to have broccoli three nights a week, that's fine by me.
Well, one thing I think I learned is that I should go over to your house for dinner. Do you cook a lot? It sure sounds like you do.
I'm cooking all the time. Probably half of the day I'm cooking. And then, of course, I'm cooking always dinner, whether or not I'm sort of developing recipes. You know, I've got two kids, and my wife usually relies upon me to do the cooking. So it's my job to sort of get dinner on the table every night. And it's, you know, one of the sort of real joys in my sort of daily routine. I mean, I think people always say to me, oh, the frozen vegetables or the bagged vegetables, they're always so easy. At the end of the day, I find nothing more relaxing than to turn on the radio and to get out a knife or a vegetable peeler and just start preparing some vegetables. It's a way to sort of unwind, to sort of collect your thoughts. You're preparing the rest of the meal. And I sort of look forward with pleasure, whether it's I'm peeling carrots or I'm washing some spinach. It's a task that I derive a lot of pleasure from, as to look at it as a chore.
A lot of what you've described to us in today's interview sounds like vegetable side dishes. But you often eat vegetarian meals. What's a good vegetarian main dish that you can suggest for us?
Well, I think in terms of vegetarian main dishes, you want to... The easiest way, I think, for most Americans to think about it is to team up with a starch. And pasta is the sort of obvious alternative. So a lot of dishes that you might think of as a vegetable side dish, of wilted spinach that's got garlic and ginger in it, can quickly become a sauce that's really just more than a it's not a tomato sauce. It's sort of taking pasta to a whole new level. If I've got some wilted spinach that I've cooked in a pan with some ginger and garlic, and I cook up some soba noodles or maybe some Chinese noodles, and it's a great, really simple vegetarian entree. And I think that's sort of the easiest way to get into it. I mean, you can start talking about beans, vegetable casseroles, and things that are a little bit more elaborate, but that's a really simple way to start.
You talked about teaming up vegetables with a starch. What about with protein?
You know, this protein issue, I feel like protein has gotten the biggest boost in the last couple of years from various diet books. I eat protein during the course of my day, but I don't think that you need to have protein at every meal, in every morsel that you're eating. Every plate does not need to have protein on it, and you will be completely fine. And I'm pretty sure most of the nutritionists out there agree with me. So that if you want to have a vegetarian meal, first of all, there's protein in pasta, not a whole lot, but certainly enough. You know, you're going to have a tuna salad, a turkey sandwich for lunch. You're going to get your protein in other places, and certainly to mix it up so that you do get protein from beans one night if you're going to have vegetarian, the soy foods, the tofus and tempehs. But there's no reason to think, oh my God, there's no protein on the plate. I'm going to suddenly start my body to fall apart. It's, again, everything sort of in moderation. And that as long as you sort of don't get into one single rut and work in as many foods as possible during the course of a week, which is really the way to think about your diet, not meal to meal or even day to day, but what you eat over the course of the week, you'll be fine.
Well, Jack Bishop, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Jack Bishop is the author of the new cookbook, Vegetables Every Day. Coming up, advice on how to improve your omelets and fried eggs from Marie Simmons, author of The Good Egg. This is Fresh Air. Many Americans who were afraid to eat eggs because of the cholesterol have returned to them now that most nutritionists approve of eggs in moderation. My guest Marie Simmons says that because of the egg phobia that gripped America for the past couple of decades, she figures that one or two generations grew up learning little or nothing about cooking, eating, and enjoying eggs. That's one of the reasons she wrote her cookbook, The Good Egg. Simmons is a winner of a James Beard Award and a Julia Child Award. Let's start with something really basic, the omelet. What's your approach to making a good omelet?
Well, I think the most important thing is to have a really good pan, and one with which means a heavy pan, one that's well-seasoned or a nonstick. It has low sloping sides, so you can get in there with your spatula and turn the omelet out. The actual cooking, I think the single most important thing about omelet making is to use a very low temperature. I know it's deceiving because recipes say quickly do this and quickly do that, and you think, well, quickly must mean high heat. But eggs really shouldn't be subjected to high heat. They should be cooked very gently. And an omelet should never be browned. It should just be just set.
You usually cook the ingredients before folding them in?
Yeah, they're cooked, they're sautéed, they're heated, they're warm because they don't really have time to cook in the omelet. You're just, by the time you put the ingredients that you want to fill the omelet with in it and you start turning it, it's ready to, you know, to be turned out of the pan.
Now, different cultures have their own versions of omelets. Like in Italy, there's frittata. How do you prepare a frittata?
Frittatas are really easy, and actually I grew up on frittata because my background's Italian, and I probably knew more about frittata before I even had heard of an omelet. But it's like an omelet in that the egg is scrambled, beaten slightly, but the ingredients go right into the eggs from the very beginning, and you cook it like a pancake, so it's one flat disc. And like so many Italian dishes, it's very unfussy, and you just turn it out and cut it in wedges, and that's the way you eat it. So there's no, you know, you don't have to be nervous about flipping it or turning it or doing anything.
How does the top cook if you don't flip it? Because like a pancake,
well,
you would flip.
Yeah, you do. And, well, that's true. You can actually, I have three ways to finish off a frittata. One, you can turn it out, which my grandmother used to do very, very skillfully, by putting a plate on top of the skillet, turning it over, and then sliding the uncooked top back into the hot skillet. That requires a little coordination. The lazy man's way, which is the way I opt to do it very often, is I turn on the broiler and just pass the pan under the broiler so the top of the frittata sets under the broiler heat, and that's just with a little grated cheese or something, and that's a great way to do it. And the other thing you can do, if you don't have your broiler on and you happen to have the oven on, you can just turn it up really high to about 500 degrees and then stick the frittata in there just for a couple of minutes, just for that top to set a little bit.
You recommend with fried eggs that you keep the egg as in an omelet on a moderate or low heat. If you cook them on a low heat, how long do you have to cook a sunny side egg for?
Well, it would several minutes, but it depends on the kind of pan you're using, and how the heat's conducted through that pan, and of course the intensity of the heat of your burner. I say, you know, low to medium low. It'll take maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes, maybe a little longer. But the white should be set. And if you want to have the yolk just look a little bit more done, just put the cover on for even just 30 seconds, but as long as a minute or two, and you'll get it a little bit more done without making the bottom get too brown and tough.
Mm-hmm. When do you throw out an egg and decide that it's not fit for cooking?
Well, I think it would have to be around my house for a pretty long time. Eggs, if they're kept very cold, meaning in the refrigerator, in the carton, not on the door, but in the carton, in the coldest part of the refrigerator, where it is well under, you know, it's under 40 degrees, will keep for a really, really long time, and they won't get bad. The rule of thumb is that an egg kept refrigerated will be fresher after 1 week than an egg kept at room temperature for 1 day. Room temperature eggs really do deteriorate quickly. And one of the reasons is that, you know, the shell is filled with tiny little holes. At one point, I think I remembered reading, there could be as many as 17,000 pores in an eggshell. And these pores will cause the egg to lose moisture, and the white will thin. The membrane around the yolk will become thin. So if you ever break an egg into a bowl, say to scramble it, and the yolk immediately splits open, and you know that it didn't catch on the shell or anything, that means that the egg is fairly old. It doesn't mean the egg's going to be bad. It's not going to taste as fresh. My favorite, what I try to do is, if I'm just going to be having soft-cooked eggs or make special scrambled egg dish, I'll make sure to get the tastiest, freshest eggs I can find. If I have an older egg in the refrigerator, maybe a half a carton that was forgotten there, or I just haven't been eating eggs lately, I will use those more easily in batters and cake batters and things like that. But eggs, they even say that you can keep eggs for sure, you know, 5 weeks in the refrigerator. And I can't imagine keeping an egg around that long because I do so much cooking. But perhaps, you know, some people do who don't eat eggs that often.
What about if you have an egg that has a dirty shell or it's cracked? Do you eat it anyways?
No, you really should not. You should not, never, never use a cracked egg in anything that's been cracked. That's why people are always checking their eggs in the supermarket before they, you know, they open the carton and they make sure none of them are cracked. Because that is, you know, that shell and that membrane inside the egg really there's a reason, and that's to protect the egg inside the shell and to keep it free of exterior bacteria. And so it's really important, you know, not to use those.
What do you do when you crack open an egg and there's a blood spot in it?
Well, what I do is what my mother did. I take the tip of a knife and I take it out and I discard it and I use the egg. That is nothing. That is simply, although it looks a little strange, it's a rupture. It takes 24 to 26 hours for a hen to form and then finally lay an egg. And she rests for about 20, 30 minutes and starts all over again. And sometimes things will happen. I mean, this is nature. I mean, things will happen. There'll be a double yolk, or there'll be a little rupture of a blood vessel in the canal where the egg is being formed, and so, but it's really harmless.
You've traveled around the world studying different eating and studying different preparation styles. Do you have a favorite egg dish from another country, another culture?
Oh, yes. The one that comes to mind immediately is something called a brick, which I ate for the very, very first time when I was in Morocco, although I think it's probably Tunisian in origin. And I do have a recipe for it, I do make it occasionally just for fun, and I have to substitute because I don't have all the ingredients that are needed to make it. But I use phyllo dough, and I break the egg into the phyllo dough. What I do is I take the phyllo dough and I put it in a little cup so that there's a little indentation, and then I break the egg into that and I fold the dough over, make this little sort of envelope package, and then I fry it in olive oil. Sometimes I put a little seasoning in there, a little spices. You can buy some harissa, which is a very popular, very hot seasoning, and maybe some cilantro leaves, and fry it. And then you've just fried enough so that the pastry gets a little golden brown, just a few minutes on each side. And when you eat it, what you have inside is an egg that with white has been cooked, but the yolk is still slightly runny. And when you bite into it, it's wonderful. It just explodes in your mouth. It kind of runs down your chin. But it's really, really wonderful. That's just one of many, many dishes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marie Simmons is the author of the cookbook, The Good Egg. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Public Announcement. This is Fresh Air. Just as Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes a generation ago served as a launching pad for a solo star, Teddy Pendergrass, so did the R&B group Public Announcement yield the solo career of the crooner R. Kelly. These days, Kelly isn't coming up with too many hits, but Public Announcement, after some personnel changes, is back making hits, such as its current Mamacita. Rock critic Ken Tucker thinks the group's new CD is the first to show its full range.
Mamacita, where you at? Been trying to reach ya. All alone, you know I need ya. Got me fiending, can I meet ya? I need to see ya. Hesitating, can't do that, don't keep me waiting. On the floor, it's getting late. And got me fiending, trying to reach ya.
The black music market is increasingly open to all sorts of styles commingling on a single CD. Diverse artists such as Outkast, Macy Gray, or Shaggy go through everything from hip-hop to reggae to soul to pop over the course of an album. Similarly, Public Announcement, a Chicago-based quartet, bases its music in traditional R&B harmonizing, but it experiments in a number of different genres. Mamacita, for example, earns its fashionable use of a Latin melodic hook coursing beneath its supple melody. Compare that to a more traditional ballad, Man Ain't Supposed to Cry, produced and sung by the group's sole remaining founding member, Earl Robinson.
Crying when you're feeling blue, lady. I've got your front. never good. And you're back when the bad girl, you don't have to worry. Let me work this out with you. Don't have to boo hoo, cause I'm the type of man that'll cry for you. Yes, I will.
They say a man ain't supposed to cry.
The way I read the credits on the current CD, the most valuable addition Earl Robinson brought into public announcement since the departure of R. Kelly, is Felony Davis, who writes complex vocal arrangements and manages to meld hip-hop chattiness with the group's more traditional vocalizing on an up-tempo tune like Don't Hold Back.
All the time, watching you smelling good, walking by, can I get a hey, oh, aha, baby, I wanna know your name, second, your name. And third, you independent, uh-huh. And you out here doing your thing.
Go, rock on with your bad self. You the business with your bad self.
Wanna let you know that if you available, well, let me know so we can holler. Take this thing to the next
come
level.
On, let's take it to
yeah.
The next one.
Keep out with me, your VIP, so see, baby. I'm gonna check you out and show you what the hell I'm all about.
Let me show you what it's all about. Mm-hmm.
I also like the way Public Announcement plays around with the vocabulary and the rhyme schemes of rapping. There's a song here called Ridiculous that showcases just that kind of adroit wit.
What the deal, baby, let the day rise. Is that all your body right? Was the force to keep you dying with them banging ass hips and thighs on mine? Got the fellas on 10, especially, especially me. The way you're poking them bangs at me is getting the best of me. Don't stop now, cause you peep me checking you. Checking two, trying to see what hotel to check into with you. Got the tightest body I've seen. Bounce that thing, it's working me. I know you're doing it purposely. Come on.
At their best, Public Announcement harks back to classic 70s R&B acts like the Isley Brothers, the Spinners, and Frankie Beverly and Maze, while gently, insistently pushing out into new, previously unexplored territory. Their basic style of He-Man harmonizing fades in and out of popularity. But with its adult themes of romantic obsession, devotion, and devastation, heady stuff that strikes a listener at gut level, this material remains the stuff of deeply committed pop music.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
After so long and being with you, say, I can't explain how much I need you. Say, you're always there.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Paradise Park by Allegra Goodman, the author of Caterskill Falls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Christopher Nolan, the screenwriter and director of Memento, a new thriller about memory and memory loss. The London Film Critics Circle named Nolan British Screenwriter of the Year for the film. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.